This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 24th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, concern mounts over U.S. contractors in Iraq. They're set to stay in the country even after the pullout of U.S. troops at the end of the year. Argentina easily re-elects Cristina de Kirchner for a historic second term by a female president in Latin America. And we'll go to Central California and talk to local residents who don't have access to what the UN calls a basic human right, safe water and sanitation. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Alice Olstein with headlines for FSRN. In Libya, the National Transitional Council declared the country liberated this weekend, but graphic photos of the body of Muammar Gaddafi are raising concerns over how and why the ex-leader was killed. UN Human Rights Office spokesperson Rupert Colville is calling for an investigation into Gaddafi's death and says he should have been spared in order to stand trial for his crimes.
When there are such serious charges against people, you always want to see them in court. And because of the rigorousness of court proceedings and what they require of the prosecution, it can be a very important element in a transitional justice situation that people get a clearer picture of what's happened, who's responsible for what.
And on Sunday, Human Rights Watch discovered the bodies of 53 apparent Gaddafi loyalists in a Sirte hotel, and the group is demanding that those responsible for the mass execution be brought to justice. As violence escalates in Syria, U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford is temporarily returning to Washington. Ford has been outspoken in his support for those protesting President Bashar al-Assad, which has made him the target of multiple threats and acts of intimidation. U.S. State Department spokesperson Mark Toner told reporters Monday that Ford's return to Damascus depended on an assessment of Syrian regime-led incitement and the security situation on the ground. The UN Security Council unanimously passed a resolution late Friday calling for a peaceful transition of power in Yemen and an immediate end to the violence and political repression. The resolution backs a proposal from the Gulf Cooperation Council, which calls for President Ali Abdullah Saleh to transfer power to his vice president, followed by the formation of an interim government, a new constitution, and elections. But Amnesty International is criticizing the announcement, saying it gives President Saleh immunity from investigation and prosecution. Rescue operations are underway in eastern Turkey, following a 7.2 magnitude earthquake on Sunday afternoon near the city of Van on the Iranian border. Hermione G. reports from Istanbul.
The death toll from Sunday's earthquake now stands at 239, according to government officials, with around 1,300 people injured. Turkey's Interior Minister Idris Naim Sahin said that while the number of dead is expected to increase, the figures are not likely to be as bad as initially feared. The small city of Erciş, 55 miles north of Van, took the brunt of the tremor, and around 80 multi-story buildings collapsed, including 4 or 5 apartment blocks and a student dormitory. Rescue operations were initially hampered by power outages and frequent aftershocks, but many survivors have been pulled from the rubble. The Turkish Red Crescent is setting up tents, field hospitals, and kitchens for people left homeless by the earthquake, but many residents still spent Sunday night outdoors in near-freezing temperatures. Hermione G., FSRN, Istanbul.
Israel and Egypt are nearing a prisoner exchange deal that would free 20 to 30 Egyptians from Israeli jails in return for the release of an Israeli-American student. 27-year-old Alon Grapel, a former IDF paratrooper, was detained in Tahrir Square last June on espionage charges. Israeli officials say the deal won't go forward until the recently signed Palestinian-Israeli prisoner swap is complete. Millions of Tunisian citizens lined up at the polls Sunday for the nation's first free democratic election. Officials say participation topped 90% as voters selected delegates for the upcoming constituent assembly that will draft a new constitution. The moderate Islamist party Ennahda has a reported early lead in many districts. The formerly banned group has said that even if it wins a majority of the 217-seat assembly, it will join a coalition with other parties to create a government that represents all Tunisians. Protesters in London have maintained a tent city outside St. Paul's Cathedral since the Occupy Wall Street movement went global in mid-October. But officials from the cathedral and the City of London say the camp creates health and safety problems, and they're trying to evict the protesters. FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports.
Protesters tried to bring their message directly to the London Stock Exchange, but St Paul's Cathedral's as close as they can get to London's financial district. One of the protesters told the crowd why he was moved to set up camp.
The current system is unsustainable. It is undemocratic and unjust. We need alternatives. This is where we work towards them.
Cathedral officials have closed St Paul's to visitors since Friday and say they're losing around $30,000 of revenue a day. Yet Christian groups such as Ecclesia, Christianity Uncut and the London Catholic Worker are calling on the cathedral to support the movement. They say resisting economic injustice with non-violence is in complete alignment with religious values. It's a direct challenge to church authorities, just as they're consulting with lawyers alongside City of London officials to evict the campers. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Occupy encampments in the U.S. are also struggling. 15 were arrested at Occupy Philadelphia on Sunday during a sit-in against police brutality. And in Portland, Maine, the protesters' camp was attacked with a homemade bomb. There were no major injuries, but organizers say they fear more acts of violence. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Washington, D.C., I'm Alice Olstein.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. President Obama has pledged a full troop withdrawal from Iraq by the end of the year, but concerns remain over the thousands of contractors, some of them armed, who will stay past the deadline, as well as the training of Iraqi police. A new report from an Iraq reconstruction watchdog criticized the State Department's handling of a program to train Iraqi police, and human rights groups are calling for greater oversight of contractors. Michael Lawson reports.
As the U.S. military draws down in Iraq by the end of the year, responsibility for U.S. operations in the country will transfer to the State Department. Language in the agreement for withdrawal, negotiated by President Bush, specified that Defense Department employees and contractors would leave the country. The resulting U.S. diplomatic presence in Iraq would be larger than any other in the world. Robert Naiman, Policy Director for Just Foreign Policy, says the State Department has never undertaken responsibilities of this magnitude and hasn't been forthcoming on their plans.
Many of the issues that led to the efforts of the U.S. to negotiate an extension of troops to fail, namely the question of immunity from Iraqi prosecution for crimes, these are issues that are going to bedevil what the State Department is doing.
A report by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction cited inefficiencies in the State Department's ability to handle a program aimed at training Iraqi police forces. The department requested nearly $900 million for the project in 2012. The Inspector General's report claims the State Department has no detailed plan for how the program will operate or what specific goals are to be accomplished. Only 12% of the $900 million would go toward actual advising of Iraqi police forces. The balance would pay for security and support for the trainers. An Iraqi government official suggested to the Inspector General's office that the money would be, quote, better spent on the American people. Naiman says Iraqis on the ground see the presence as a remnant of the U.S. occupation.
It would probably be better for this not to exist at all. There isn't any strong case that U.S. training at this point is particularly better than any other training that the Iraqis could get.
Despite progress, Iraq is still a country racked by violence. The State Department estimates 4,000 to 5,000 private security contractors would be required to maintain security for the diplomatic force. Human Rights First released a series of recommendations for oversight for security contractors, including criminal accountability and clear remedies for victims of contractor crimes. Melina Malazzo of Human Rights First is concerned not enough has been done to track the impact of contractors in Iraq so far.
There has not been to date a serious accounting of some of the abuses that occurred by contractors in places like Iraq and Afghanistan against the civilian population.
Malazzo cites the 2007 incident in Nasir Square in which 17 civilians were killed by employees of security contractor Blackwater, now known as Z. While Malazzo says steps toward progress have been taken, She says there is still more to be done to persuade the Iraqi people.
We still haven't passed legislation to at least be able to say, if we're fielding U.S. contractors abroad and if they commit serious crimes of violence or abuse towards the local civilian population, that we will hold them accountable.
Legislation has been introduced that would provide for U.S. criminal accountability, but it is stalled. Contracts awarded to three large security firms so far total nearly $3 billion, with more to come. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
Proposed changes to the FBI's DNA database system could have wide implications for years to come. The FBI calls it a major upgrade, but some forensic scientists question the move. One of the changes would increase the number of genetic markers tested and kept in records, broadening the pool of data. Meanwhile, concerns over privacy and the data's role in criminal defense persist. For more, we are joined by Barry Steinhardt, chair of Friends of Privacy USA and an expert on privacy and the law. Barry Steinhardt, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The FBI's system is referred to as CODIS, which stands for Combined DNA Index System. There's been an increase in use over the years by federal law enforcement. The proposed change here would increase from 13 to 24 the number of loci that are tested for and included in DNA records. What's the significance of this?
Well, first, let me correct one thing. It's not just federal law enforcement that uses it. It's probably predominantly state and local law enforcement that uses it as well. But what the FBI is proposing now is to dramatically increase the number of loci, or essentially genetic markers, which will be examined. That significantly increases the odds that the you're going to get a match, which indicates not a particular individual, but either someone who is related to that individual, or for some ethnic groups, for example, Asians who live in a particular geographic location in the United States, it may well identify only that individual is a member of that group.
So what kind of implication would that have in an investigation or in a case with this expansion of the loci and, as you're describing it, the expansion of just an individual to a race or an ethnic group?
Well, it's primarily going to be seen in a vast increase in the amount of what is referred to as familial searching. In other words, that a particular individual is not implicated in the crime, or may be implicated in the crime, but you're searching for everybody that's related to that individual. That means that innocent people are going to find that police officers are knocking at their door. They may find that they are being accused of a crime or being suspected of a crime, even when the person they are related to is not a match for the genetic sample. Third, of course, you're going to find a lot of people who are going to learn family secrets, for example, that they are related to someone by a genetic match who was the product of rape or incest, or someone that they didn't know was a relative. So you have all those consequences for this, what is likely to be a vast increase in the amount of familial searching.
The FBI, with regard to familial searching, makes the case that it would help in the search of missing persons. Are you convinced at all by that argument?
No. The truth is that we have samples, generally speaking, of individuals who are missing, mostly children, so you can make an exact match. There is no real chance that this is going to significantly increase the success of searching for missing persons.
There are some broader issues of privacy here, and you've brought up several of them in the past. One is access to the database by defense lawyers for their clients. Another is restricting this to known offenders, taking the DNA from known offenders. Also a time limit so the DNA is destroyed after a certain period. Have any of these issues been addressed by the FBI?
No, none of these issues have been addressed. In fact, the FBI's proposal and other recent changes that they've made in policy for the CODIS system vastly increase. They really exacerbate the civil liberties problems. They don't address them.
And how large is this pool right now? How many people, how much information is in this database?
Oh, there are. I don't remember the exact number, but there are millions of records in the system. It's important to recognize, I think, to be fair here, that CODIS doesn't have the actual genetic sample. What it has is the record of the test that has been done. The actual genetic samples are largely held by state and local authorities. They are warehoused. One of the things that I have said in the past is really worrying here is that most jurisdictions do not destroy those samples after they have been obtained, which means that there is a tremendous temptation to do exactly what the FBI is doing here, which is to go back and propose to retest the samples, looking for not only more loci, but other characteristics that we may now be able to identify: race, ethnicity, hair color, handedness, all those sorts of things. One way to prevent those kinds of civil liberty sins would be to destroy the original samples, but most jurisdictions don't do that.
Barry Steinhardt is founder of Friends of Privacy USA and a retired longtime staffer at the ACLU. Thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And in related news, a Texas death row inmate is requesting DNA testing for evidence that he says would prove his innocence. Today, lawyers in Amarillo are arguing before a federal judge for Henry Watkins Skinner, who was convicted for the 1993 killings of his girlfriend and her two sons. Skinner's lawyers say previous DNA testing by prosecutors was selective and only proved that he was present at the scene of the crime, but not that he committed the murders. The Texas State Attorney General calls the request a delay tactic. Skinner is scheduled for execution on November 9th. FSRN will hold its 2011 annual meeting on Sunday, October 30th at 9:30 a.m. Pacific and 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. This meeting will be via teleconference. You can attend by dialing 218-486-1611. The code is annual pound sign. That number again is 218-486-1611, and the code is annual, that's A-N-N-U-A-L, and then press the pound sign. For more information, visit fsrn.org. Argentina re-elected President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in the South American nation's presidential elections on Sunday. The president has ridden a wave of support driven by a strong economy and public sympathy after the death of her husband and former president last year. But at times, her style of leadership has come under criticism. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner won a landslide victory with 54% of the vote. Fernandez de Kirchner is the first female president to be re-elected in all of Latin America, and the victory margin is one of the largest in Argentina's history.
Una Argentina donde tengamos continuidad.
During her victory speech, she promised to expand a project to improve the lives of 40 million Argentines. The president's speech was tinged with sadness as Fernandez de Kirchner evoked the legacy of her late husband and predecessor, Néstor Kirchner. He died of a heart attack last year. Following his death, public support for the widow leader surged. Both Cristina and her late husband have been likened to Juan and Eva Perón, the legendary 1950s populist leader and his wife. The Perones were credited with industrialization and populist economic policies, just as the Kirchners are with Argentina's economic revival following the 2001 financial collapse. Rather than enact austerity measures, the Kirchner government took over private pensions, used federal dollars to stimulate spending, and placed a larger financial burden on investors in foreign markets. Lorena Garcia is among the 78% of eligible voters in Argentina who cast ballots this weekend. She said that she supports the president because of the social reforms implemented during her government.
Her victory implies a continuation of an economic and political model that she and her husband have built. One negative aspect is that it frightens me to have one person in office for so many years. But what is positive is that the president has implemented many progressive social measures for women, universal subsidy for children, media reforms, and improving equality with same-sex marriage.
Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has been criticized for her confrontational leadership style and unconventional economic policies. In 2008, her popularity plummeted during a battle over taxes on soy exports. The president has clearly recovered from the drop, softening her combative tone and proving that she can govern on her own. But Miguel Forte, professor of sociology at the University of Buenos Aires, says that the president's monolithic style could cause friction within her government.
Without a doubt, there's been a general sense of improvement in people's living conditions in Argentina. In addition to the economy, there's an emotional component that has led to massive support for the president. We'll have to discuss the advantages and disadvantages of an emotional relationship between the masses and a charismatic leader.
Emotion ran high as tens of thousands celebrated Fernandez de Kirchner's win in the capital's Plaza de Mayo. The president, still dressed in widow's black, danced as her supporters cheered and echoed her election campaign promise to ensure continued economic growth and to close the gap between the rich and poor by spreading the nation's wealth. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
The United Nations officially recognized the human right to water and sanitation in 2008, with the U.S. signing on last year. The UN Human Rights Commission appointed Portuguese human rights attorney Catarina de Albuquerque as the special rapporteur for that right, with the authority to investigate and report on conditions throughout the world. Today, de Albuquerque presented findings to the UN General Assembly from a visit to three U.S. communities in March. What she found, she said, were patterns of discrimination and exclusion due to lack of political will. Some U.S. leaders seemed to take notice. Earlier this month, California's Governor Jerry Brown signed into law a bill package addressing safe drinking water, and in signing it, he called access to water a human right. Yet similar patterns persist in communities around the country. FSRN's Vic Bedoyan describes one such community in California's Central Valley.
There are many small rural communities in the Central Valley where people can't or shouldn't drink the water. The village of Seville in Tulare County is one of them. Surrounded by orchards and vineyards, Seville has 75 homes and 350 residents who are mainly farm workers with an average salary of $16,000 a year. Susana DeAnda is co-director of the Community Water Center, a group that has helped residents organize to demand their human right to water.
For a long time, it's been very consistent. Who gets clean drinking water, who doesn't? And it's very clear if you're low income and a person of color, and if you live in the Central Valley, you're going to have higher chances of having contaminated drinking water. That is intentional racism.
Those conditions brought Catarina de Albuquerque to Seville as the United Nations rapporteur for the human right to water and sanitation. She met with local residents, activists, and experts, having earlier investigated water and sanitation in Egypt, Costa Rica, Slovenia, Bangladesh, and Japan. De Albuquerque told the group that the human right to water means it has to be available, accessible, and affordable.
When we talk about affordability, it means that for you to be able to have access to water, you don't have to be forced to make choices between human rights, between the right to water and the right to food, or the right to water and the right to health care, or the right to water and the right to housing, as I have seen in different communities.
Residents of Seville say sand and algae is common in tap water, forcing them to buy bottled water. School board member Rebecca Quintana grew up and raised a family in Seville. She showed the UN rapporteur a water system typical of what 500,000 Valley residents live with.
The county took receivership of our water system because it wasn't being run legally. And just recently they put a chlorinator in there to clear our water up. But before that, the person that was trying to run the water was just pouring Clorox into our water system. You would find bottles thrown all around our water tank, and people started opening their eyes and saying, "What's going on? Clorox." But that's the way it was being treated. But now that the county took over, they have put this system in, and that's where it runs into the well. And as we walk down there, you'll see one of our distribution lines that runs down right in the middle of our irrigation ditch.
In addition to dilapidated water systems, most Central Valley groundwater is contaminated in varying degrees. The most prevalent pollutants are nitrates from agricultural fertilizer and arsenic, which occurs naturally but may also be found in some farm chemicals. Michelle Hunter lives in Alpaugh and says people drive to Delano, 20 miles away, to buy clean water.
What about cooking? Can you cook with the tap water?
Oh, no. It concentrates. When you put heat to it, it concentrates the arsenic. So, no, we don't cook with it at all.
Another resident, Veronica Mendoza, lives amid citrus groves in Orosi, where nitrates are above the maximum contaminant level allowed by law. She says her son and her neighbors are directly affected.
When he take a shower, he got a rash after shower. Every day, and my neighbors, they have the teeth, like yellow and black, like the doctor said, there's the water.
Numerous other ailments, some very serious, have been reported in these communities. Maria Herrera is outreach coordinator for the Community Water Center. She says water may not be the only cause of health problems, but it's part of the cumulative impact of living in a farming region without suitable infrastructure.
The same communities that are affected without having safe drinking water are also the same communities who work in the fields, who are exposed to pesticides. They have a lot of issues to deal with besides just, you know, drinking water.
The California legislature recently passed a package of bills making it easier for communities to get funding for improvements. Susanna DeAnda hopes that residents can finally get the clean water they deserve.
People are tired of not having adequate service when it comes to water. It's inhumane that today in 2011 in California, we have these third world conditions when it comes to drinking water here. And that has to change.
Katarina de Albuquerque reported her findings to the UN Human Rights Commission on September 15th. Today, she told FSRN about her recommendations to address the disparities of access to adequate water and sanitation.
One of the things that I recommended to the U.S. was to adopt a national affordability, a mandatory national affordability threshold. The same way that EPA has a mandatory water quality standards, there should be affordability standards for the whole country. And when you look at the people in Seville who are devoting 18% of their household income to water and sanitation, that's completely unacceptable.
The special rapporteur told the UN today that water and sanitation for disadvantaged communities in the U.S. is underfinanced and that money which is allocated is often not well spent. Vic Bedoyan, FSRN, Fresno.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Nell Abrams, sitting in for Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Alice Olstein. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.